which is a grey start to our Saturday, but a day of sunshine and showers, increasingly wintry, those showers in the north on Saturday. So it looks like the better of the 2 days, because by Sunday there's more wet and windy weather coming in. The warnings are already out for that, Mairead.
And the high winds will certainly be featuring in the shipping forecast later. Thanks, Helen. Helen Willetts there at the BBC Weather Centre. Well, now on Radio 4, we continue with our Book of the Week, Gold by Matthew Hart. Communist China frowned on gold mining. Lenin had defined its place in socialist thinking when he said that they would make the toilets out of gold after the revolution. But it's a very different in China today, where everyone wants a share of the action.
In a 10-year exploration binge, China grew from an insignificant gold producer into the world's biggest, replacing South Africa in 2007. They were buying gold too. In 2012, Thomson Reuters GFMS, the world's leading precious metals consultant, predicted that Chinese private and government buying would amount to almost 1,000 tons of gold that year, a rate of consumption that would make it a bigger gold buyer than the traditional leader, India. The story of Chinese gold tells the story of the Chinese state. Its transformation from an inward-looking, technologically backward country into a money mill. They have 10,000 gold mines, or maybe 60,000. I was told both. No one seems to know the number. Chinese gold is as much a frenzy as an industry. Some mines are no more than a single family with gold pans and a stretch of river. Others exploit large deposits from Myanmar to the Mongolian border. Inner Mongolia's fountain of coal had already showered the province with millionaires. Many of them seem to be staying at my hotel in the industrial city of Baotou. The ground floor bar blazed with gold Rolexes. Outside, a red Maserati glowed among the ranks of jet-black SUVs. A corps of stony-faced drivers with mirrored glasses waited for their bosses. A dusty white Toyota Land Cruiser came roaring up the drive and pulled to a stop beside me. I climbed in, and we sped away. The road north of Baotou climbs into Orange Mountains. From the heights, you can see the green haze of fields along the Yellow River. First, we drove on a four-lane highway that wound through foothills. Every few miles, our driver slowed to a crawl, crept past a parked police car, then shot back to his normal speed. In a series of sprints, we made our way through the mountains and onto the plain until, clear of police, the driver accelerated to breakneck speed. For half an hour, we sailed along the motorway. I could see the green glow of agriculture far off to the left. Without warning, the driver shot off the freeway onto an unmarked dirt track that plunged into a dry creek bed. We bucked along through gravel and fine sand, throwing up red plumes that broke across the bonnet. Sad-looking, crumbling hamlets appeared and receded. A village clustered at a crossroads around some engine shops and a truck cafe. We came to a railroad construction site. A ridge of gravel ran like a ruler across the plain from one horizon to the other, with a notch left for the highway. The humps of Mongol burial mounds appeared on the plain, and sometimes a more elaborate painted concrete tomb with a shallow dome and a forecourt surrounded by a low white wall. I thought of the Mongols riding out of this plain in the 13th century. Now, native Mongolians fear that mining and the migration of ethnic Chinese will annihilate what remains of their nomadic life. A month before I visited, in June of 2011, Mongol protests brought riot police into the streets of the provincial capital, Hohhot, after a Chinese truck driver ran down and killed a Mongol herder who was trying to block a coal truck convoy from crossing grasslands. China executed the truck driver, but the convoys have not stopped. Black clouds had been building for an hour, and then a squall dashed out and drummed on the roof. We crept along with the wipers flailing and came to a pirate mine. The site was abandoned in the rain. A front-end loader and a truck were parked beside a hovel. Smoke oozed from a stovepipe and dribble down the wall. Sluices and a sifting screen stood by the river, with ramps for the trucks to bring ore. The miners had diverted the river, dredged the bed, and had been washing gravel down the sluices to collect grains of gold. They had messed up the river for miles, and would certainly have bribed local officials. In China, I often saw miners foraging in rivers. Once, in Shandong province, I watched a highway crew with a digger scooping out a stream to patch the road, and while they were at it, running gravel down a sluice to look for gold. China is the world's biggest gold producer, not because it has large mines, but because it teems with small ones. The government itself created the boom. In the 1980s, before the country opened exploration to Western companies, the government tried to stimulate production by lifting state control of small mines. The new policy sparked a gold rush. Gold seekers ransacked prospective ground in every corner of China. They poured into Ching Kai province in the Tibetan uplands and the Xinjiang Uyghur region, the largest administrative division of China. 641,000 square miles of deserts and mountains and gold-bearing streams. Contemporary gold extraction uses complicated processes that consume energy, materials, and demand specialized knowledge. But people have been refining gold for centuries without the help of engineers or substantial capital. Probably the most common method is mercury amalgamation. The problem is that mercury poisons those who handle it and ruins the environment. And mercury amalgamation is not the only toxic method that the Chinese used. The hill miners use cyanide too. Men on motorcycles carried drums up the mountain tracks. The miners built leach pits downstream from the digs and poured in the cyanide. It leaked, poisoning people and causing widespread cattle deaths. In 1988, the Chinese government reversed its liberalizing policy and gold became a special mineral under government protection. But the genie would not return to the bottle. For many Chinese, the idea had taken root that gold alone could free them from penury. In 1989, the Christian Science Monitor profiled the sad adventure of a farmer named Ma, who set out on a March day to seek his fortune in the gold fields of Ching Kai province. Ma hired a dozen men, spent his life savings on shovels, tents, food, and a truck, and left his ripening barley to the hoeing of his wife. The men drove out of their village, crossed the Sun and Moon Mountains, and struck out westward across the high plain of Ching Kai. Ma and his crew were following a stream of outlaw prospectors and gold diggers who were ignoring the prohibition on private mining. The lure of gold was too great to resist, and the get-rich-quick promise of the crazy yellow rush, with its stories of instant millionaires, drew them to the remote quarters of the province. Local officials also defied the law, helping the miners and pocketing substantial bribes. One group in the central Ching Kai city of Golmut reportedly made $270,000 selling bogus mining licenses. Ma and his team travelled nearly 1,000 miles on the rough roads that led to the gold country. Rain fell and the snow blew in and the roadway turned to mud. They ran into other gold seekers mired in the sucking mess. More than 8,000 men and 1,000 trucks were tangled in hopeless disarray. They had reached an altitude of 16,500 feet, within sight of the famed gold platform at Kukshil Lake. And then, the food ran out. News of the calamity reached the authorities, and the army tried to make a food drop. But the pilots could not find the stranded miners, concealed from the air by thick cloud. More than 70 men died in the freezing pass. Finally, the army reached them with helicopters, bringing food. Ma and the others were ordered to abandon their doomed convoy and leave the area on foot. The disaster in Ching Kai did not eliminate small-scale gold mining. The fever had taken root. Moreover, small mining was an immemorial tradition. In acknowledgement of this, the government found a way to tolerate small workings under an unwritten but well-understood convention known as localistic protection, a Maoist concept that gave weight to the folkways of the people. The people knew an opportunity when they saw one. In Hunan province, 178 small mining teams used the cover of localistic protection to seize ground adjacent to state-owned mines. Some brazenly entered mines and collected ore at the minehead. In an incident at the Wenyu mine, the carrying ore on the back people had gathered so much ore they had to commandeer trucks to haul it away. Sometimes, freelance miners organized into village cooperatives, a system known as Minsai, or village mining. Even large state companies use Minsai to recover hard-to-get-at ore, in one case suspending miners on ropes and lowering them 120 feet down shafts. In Shandong province, Minsai provided important income. But in 2001, in another shift of central government sentiment, the state abolished the system, declaring 295 mines and 138 refining operations illegal in Shandong alone. Officially, such micro-mining no longer exists, and gold recovery has passed to the industrial apparatus. This fiction does not withstand even the most cursory investigation. In 1995, gold lords and their bands of peasant miners were still defying the government and each other. I've heard the bullets whizzing past my ears and seen people beside me dying, a woman in her 40s told a reporter. Gold lords fought for the best ground. The first thing we would do when we struck gold, one said, was set up a pillbox on the mountaintop and train more of our workers how to use guns. Then we would use our blankets to make a flag, which meant, this mountain belongs to us. Rival gangs fought pitched battles with pistols, automatic weapons, and even homemade cannon. They chewed up the landscape with their mining, sending soil from the digs into rivers, threatening the habitat of such rare animals as snow leopards and white-lipped deer. In 2012, nomadic Tibetan shepherds in Ching Kai fought with Chinese gold miners to keep them from digging a mountain that the Tibetans held sacred. Nothing, it seems, could stop the sack of China for its gold. It begs the question, with such intense mining, how much gold can be left? In 2010, the World Gold Council warned that China may exhaust existing gold mines in 6 years or less if Chinese demand continues to grow strongly. For anyone in the gold business, other than Chinese miners, this was great news. China running out of gold? Imagine what would happen to the price. The China running out of gold scenario raises the spectre of peak gold, the scary bedtime story that gold producers like to tell. Peak gold describes the theoretical point of maximum world extraction, after which it's downhill all the way, as production fades, until we've dug up every ounce and there's no gold left to mine. I don't know how much gold China has in the ground, and neither does the WGC. Neither do the Chinese. But if they show signs of running out, the gold price will reach escape velocity. What it will escape is human reason.
Gold, the Race for the World's Most Seductive Metal, was written by Matthew Hart. It was abridged by Pete Nichols and was read by Robert Glenister. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. And there we must leave sailing by, because it's now time for the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday the 24th of January. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North at Cera, South at Cera, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Fisher, German Bight, Sole, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low, South East Iceland, 991, losing its identity by 1800 Friday. New low expected 100 miles west of Iceland, 952 by same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking, North at Cera, South at Cera, southeast 40s. Southeasterly gale 8 or severe gale 9, occasionally storm 10, except northeast 40s, perhaps violent storm 11.